The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
Hi, listeners. Thank you for joining us. This is Dr. Renee Rosati, and we're going to talk about some pearls of wisdom from other interventional spine physiatrists around the U.S. Today, we have Dr. Aaron Conger with us. He's an assistant professor at the University of Utah, and he does mainly interventional spine in his practice. Today's topic is cervical transforaminal epidural steroid injection versus interlaminar epidural steroid injection. Which do you feel is more effective? Which do you feel is more dangerous? And any other procedure planning tips that he may want to touch on? Dr. Conger.
So I think the more people you talk to about this, the more opinions you'll get. I think it's heavily influenced by your own experience and where you trained. I think, you know, at this point in my career, I'm pretty comfortable with either approach and either procedure, but there was definitely a time where I was much more comfortable with transforaminals than interlams just because of the volume that I'd done. And I have, yeah, I have partners and other people that I know really well that feel the opposite way. You know, they trained at a type of program where they did a lot more interlams and very few transforaminals. They feel very uncomfortable with transforaminals. So I think a lot of it is volume dependent. I think the other big thing I'd say is that either of them can be performed very safely in the right hands, in the right patient at the right time. But if those variables are off, neither is going to be a good option. So in terms of what I prefer, you know, I think it really depends first before we're talking about like effectiveness or ideal patient selection. Can a certain procedure be performed safely in an individual with their anatomy? So the transforaminal approach can be completely contraindicated based on arterial anatomy in the neck. And that's why it's really important for an interventionalist to read their own MRIs, just as if they're a radiologist. Radiologists will not comment. Sometimes they'll comment on anomalous vertebral artery anatomy, but many times not say anything at all. They certainly are not going to talk about an anomalous or very posterior carotid. And normally placed carotid can be completely obstructing the C2, you know, the upper cervical intervertebral foramen like C2, C3, and C3, C4. They certainly won't comment on that. So don't assume that your referring providers have looked at it either. So you need to look at it yourself. So I think assuming that you've got, and same thing with interlaminar approaches, you know, somebody can be referred to you with very severe C71 or C67 central stenosis. And maybe they also have radicular symptoms, but they've got pretty severe narrowing at that level. You'll look at your MRI and your T1 sequences and see, you know, basically ligamentum flavum followed by spinal cord immediately adjacent, right? There's no epidural space right there. And the whole thing is just plastered right up against the lamina. And so that's, you know, by definition, if you do happen to get that needle across the ligamentum flavum, the tip of it's going to be in the spinal cord. So it doesn't matter how good you are at it. That's not a procedure that's going to work. So I think just making sure you've got the right person in front of you and the right procedure indicated. As far as effectiveness goes, I mean, I think there's been lots of studies that have looked at this. We've been a part of head-to-head trials where we've looked at standard transforaminal versus C71 interlam. We've looked at C71 interlam versus C71 interlam with a catheter. There's been head-to-head studies looking at a number of other approaches, and I've you know published systematic reviews on this sort of thing. Not in the last few years, so if there's been newer things, I may not really know about it. But my impression of after looking at you know dozens and dozens of these studies is that basically effectiveness is the same between the routes. So I think it has to do to some degree with comfort. I think there are certain advantages of one over the other. So if you're working with surgeons, many times they like to have what they'll call a selective nerve root block or a low volume transforaminal for diagnostic purposes. It helps them to have a better idea of whether a patient's pain is truly related to, you know, moderate stenosis at C6, C7 versus moderate stenosis at C5, C6, neuroforaminal stenosis. So it may be a little bit more of a diagnostic value in a transforaminal. So I think I prefer transforaminal approach, usually first line in somebody with unilateral monoradicular pain that doesn't have like four or five bad levels. On the flip side, if somebody has, this is just personal, I'm not saying this is right or wrong. If somebody has bilateral symptoms with one bad level, then I'll usually use a transforaminal still. If somebody's got multiple levels that look really bad, you know, shot neck syndrome, whatever you want to call it, and you just don't, you're like, oh, I don't know. I mean, maybe this is C6, maybe it's C7. There's a huge amount of overlap in those symptoms, as most people know. then an interlam can be a good first line treatment. And then, you know, obviously if one doesn't work, try the other. In my anecdotally, I found that some people respond very well to one versus the other.
That's great. Thank you. Yes, it's definitely nice to have both these skills in our repertoires. One other thing I wanted to ask is about if you have a patient that needs a cervical interlaminar and has a true contrast allergy, so anaphylaxis, throat swelling of some kind to our iodinated contrast, what do you do with that patient?
So I think this is a great question because you probably get a lot of different responses depending on who you talk to. But for me personally, I wouldn't use gadolinium-based contrast in the neck. There's now, I think we call it the multi-society work group, MPW, you know, sort of recommendations on this. And the recommendation is not to use gadolinium in any interlaminar type procedure at any level in the spine. So if you deviate, if you consider that, you know, to be reasonably within the standard of care and you deviate away from that and something bad happens, you're not really going to have a leg to stand on, if that makes sense. So I tend to think along those lines, I think, when I'm figuring out what I'm going to do with somebody one way or the other when it comes to something that's elective like this. So I wouldn't use, you know, pro-hands or multi-hands in the neck for an interlam. I do pre-treat people that have iodinated contrast allergies. It's kind of unfortunate that it ends up being like 150 milligrams of prednisone before their cervical injection. So you have to consider, you know, cumulative corticosteroid burden in people like that and weigh the risks and the benefits. So it's a tough one, you know, but that's me personally.
And you have to discuss the risks of having anaphylaxis, even with the Benadryl and prednisone. What about for the cervical transaminals with a contrast allergy?
Oh, man. Well, I have and do use multi-hands or pro-hands for transforaminal epidural steroid injections, basically at all levels of the spine. And that might not necessarily, I'd have to go back and look at that guideline and see what they think about that. But I'm not too concerned. I don't know that I've ever really gotten an intrathecal injection from a nerve, or, you know, from a dural root sleeve that was halfway out the foramen in the neck. I've never seen that before. So I think that the risk of that is probably pretty low. Certainly the risk of getting some intravascular gadolinium is possible, but that's not really the same problem as what we're talking about with intrathecal gadolinium. So I do use Prohance at pretty much all levels of the spine with transferables after, you know, full informed consent of the risks and benefits.
And what if the patient asks you, doc, can you do my injection without contrast in my neck?
Do no harm. That's the way I look at it. And I think I've had to explain that maybe to one person. It doesn't come up very often. It's usually somebody that was having, you know, has a you know, known diagnosis of severe anaphylaxis, iodinated contrast, that then sees another interventionalist who was performing this procedure for them and then switches to my practice. That's the scenario where this comes up. Otherwise, I wouldn't offer the treatment in the first place. So it's happened, and I usually just have to explain to them some of the catastrophic things that have happened and that I'm not comfortable doing that for those reasons. And I haven't had anybody really fight me on it, you know?
Okay, so just to reiterate that, you tell patients no if they need a neck injection and ask for it without contrast. That's not an option. Okay. Well, thank you for being so clear and concise. I think these are awesome, you know, pearls of wisdom. And we thank you, everyone, for listening. Is there any other final points you want to add before we sign off?
No, I mean, I think it's just, you know, either approach is effective. You use all the principles of good imaging, good patient selection, and an appropriate use of the right contrast media and the right person.
All right. Thank you so much.